Jim Glick, your book on Isaac Newton has been the big pleasure of my summer reading, I got to say. More revealing than a falling apple, somebody said. I'm sitting at my computer saying, yes, he was the architect of our machinery, of our thinking, our consciousness. He was the proto-scientist, as you write, of computation, relentless observation. The architect, as much as Christopher Wren, his friend, was the architect of St. Paul's Cathedral. But what I'm really wondering is, what would the architect make of the neighborhood that he laid out some 300 years later?
I wish I knew. He would find it a very strange neighborhood because his world was so different. It was so dark and medieval and alien to us. And half of the difficulty of this project for me was trying to understand and then trying to convey how ancient the world he lived in was, how little was known, how badly things were misunderstood, and how far he had to go. His father was an illiterate farmer. He was the first man in his family to know how to read and write. So not only did he not have a computer to sit in front of, but he didn't have a book in the household when he was growing up. And he was almost an orphan. His father died before he was born, and his mother abandoned him at home. And he lived in a place where there was no intellectual life. It's a kind of miracle that we can't even begin to understand today that by the time he was in his early 20s, he had made himself, in isolation, the greatest mathematician in Europe. He didn't know that. There was no way to know it, and no one else knew it for generations to come. But we can see it now by looking at his papers.
Well, you quote his great rival, Leibniz, in Germany, telling the Queen of Prussia that in mathematics there was all previous history from the beginning of the world, and then there was Newton, and that Newton's was the better half.
Yes, and that was a particularly generous comment, because by then Leibniz hated Newton, and these two great men, two real geniuses in mathematics, were at war from different sides of the English Channel. It was ugly.
You know, let me just say, this book and his life is full of miracles. I kept thinking of Newton, I mean, for all his incredible understanding and his writing, his science, and it is science, there's a great deal of the idiot savant about him. I mean, he keeps reminding me of those feeble-minded twins that, you know, when hundreds of matchsticks are poured out on the ground, they can tell you exactly, instantly, how many there are. Newton had the same almost unexplainable aptitude for going from equation to graph to moving reality to planetary systems all in the blink of an eye.
Yes, he did. And there's no anecdotal history to the effect that he was that kind of lightning calculator. You know, there are no stories of his doing amazing feats of computation in a very short time and impressing the neighborhood. But then there wouldn't be, because that sort of thing didn't exist. If he was that kind of savant, we wouldn't necessarily know it. What we can see, though, is quite a bit about the nature of his mathematical genius, and we can see just by following the trail of his scratchings on paper with his quill pen, that he computed and computed and computed obsessively. He would hold these mathematical objects in his head like a circus performer holding a stack of balanced objects at great length until he could see his way through. Now I'm starting to mix metaphors, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's completely clear to people who are mathematicians and who are competent to understand his mathematics, which I'm not, that he was still, even if you transmitted him somehow into our time, he would still stand as the greatest mathematician in history.
But in a strange way, he'd still have so much to learn. I look at my IBM ThinkPad and wonder, I mean, it's all Newton, but I wonder, you know, if he were here for a day in 2003, what would he want to see? The Hubble telescope, an MRI machine, rockets, satellites, the space program perhaps, global positioning satellites that tell somebody in a rent-a-car, you know, when to turn left. What's your guess? I mean, what would you want to show him? starting with your own computer.
What you're talking about, in a way, is the kind of basic biographer fantasy, at least fantasy for biographers who never get to meet their subject. And I'm sure that if you write a biography of Beethoven, you have to think, if only he could be here with me in Carnegie Hall listening to this performance of his violin concerto, what would he think? You know, how would he like it? Are we doing it right? And by the way, how would he feel about Schoenberg? But with Newton, I found myself thinking, I don't want to meet the guy. And I'm not sure if we were going to bring somebody into the 20th century, 21st century now, he's the one I would want to bring. I kept thinking, I'd rather have a beer with Edmund Halley, who was a great adventurer and traveled all around the world, and I think would have been fascinated by the modern world. Newton was a strange case. He didn't travel anywhere. He was reclusive. He lived in his head and with his sheets of paper, and he loved machinery as a kid. He was fascinated. When I say machinery, there wasn't any, but he was fascinated by the water mill that was being built in the town of Grantham, where he was going to school, and tried to make wooden models. So I'm not saying he wouldn't have liked modern gadgets, but I'm not sure that the modern world would have been of automatic interest to him.
Would he say, aha, I told you so?
He wasn't trying to create this world. We have this sense that because he did create it, he must have had a goal in mind. Because he created a school of mathematics, he invented more or less all of what we now call physics. The word didn't really exist then, except as the name of a book by Aristotle.
Yeah, in the space of about 18 months in his early 20s, I mean...
But he wasn't setting out to do that. He wasn't setting out to create a cult or to develop a following or to teach other people or to make the world a better place. He really wasn't trying to do that. That wasn't his goal. He wanted to know things because in his mind he was obsessed, and maybe he thought he was on a mission from God to understand the secrets of the universe. But the mission didn't include explaining the secrets of the universe to everybody else. He would have been perfectly content, at least during his most creative years, to find it all out and hide it in a drawer. Because, in fact, that's what he did do. When he discovered or invented or created, choose your verb, the calculus in his early 20s, he didn't tell anybody about it. He hid it. He used it himself for 20 years as a mathematical tool, but he didn't tell anybody.
But, yeah, he reminds me of Emily Dickinson in that way. Just put another poem in the drawer.
I think that's actually a great comparison. It never occurred to me. But, yes.
Can I read just a little bit of this wonderful book, Jim, and it's to give people a sense of your style, but also the man. You write, by Newton's 30s, his hair was already gray, falling to his shoulders and usually uncombed. He was thin and equine, with a strong nose and gibbous eyes. He stayed in his chamber for days at a time, careless of meals, working by candlelight. He was scarcely less isolated when he dined in the hall. The fellows of Trinity College, Cambridge, learned to leave him undisturbed at table and to step around diagrams that he scratched with his stick in the gravel of the walkways. They saw him silent and alienated, with shoes down at the heel and stockings untied. He feared disease, plague, and pox, and treated himself preemptively by drinking a self-made elixir of turpentine, rose water, olive oil, beeswax, and sack. In fact, he was poisoning himself slowly by handling mercury. Very strange devil.
I guess I'm making him out to be a little bit crazy, to use a technical term. And in fact, 15 or 20 years after that point in his life, he did have what we would today call a nervous breakdown. Mm. He had some kind of mental breakdown. His friends were afraid that he either would or had killed himself. Mm. He was alone. There are people who speculate today that he may have had a mild form of autism. I don't find that especially valuable, you know, trying to come up with the appropriate anachronistic psychological jargon. But he had issues. And we have to wonder whether this kind of madness or mental instability was in any way separable from the kind of genius he was, whether you could have the genius without the madness.
Interesting. You know, you write in the book, Jim, that Newton, in many deep respects, was not a Newtonian. He was not the man of pure reason, laws, order that he was later held up to be, or that he came to stand for in objective science. Isaac Newton is held responsible, especially by the Romantic reaction, for trying to reduce reality to a system of rules and laws and complete mechanistic order. How do we deal with that?
Well, he did do that. The word reduce is a pejorative-sounding word, but he found the systems and rules and laws underlying the phenomena of nature, and in doing that, he performed a great service, because that is how nature works. It is organized. But he also now stands as an icon of a kind of rationality that again, as you say, the Romantic poets hated Newton, especially William Blake, who understood him very well. I don't think Blake would appreciate my saying so, but I think he had great mathematical intuition and hated Newton because he got Newton, and also because he blamed Newton for what was happening to the English landscape in a time of industrialization that flowed from the scientific advances that Newton was responsible for. If Blake held Newton responsible for the graying of England, well, that's completely unfair in a way, and yet it's not stupid. It wasn't foolish of Blake. Yet, the Newton they created, a mythological Newton, who is very much to this day the Newton we have in our heads, isn't the real person. Newton was not, as a person, a paragon of rationality.
Mm.
He didn't believe in a completely deterministic, orderly universe that could be just reduced to a few scientific principles. He believed in the scientific principles, but he also understood that they didn't explain everything, that the universe is a chaotic place. He believed in all kinds of spiritual things, God, to begin with, but also inexplicable, mysterious forces. It's not an accident that he spent his most productive years doing not the physics he's now famous for, but alchemy, and that a lot of that alchemy, when you read it today, is crazy. Fermentation and a lot of sexual imagery in it.
I kind of like that about him.
Well, I like it about him, too, because, you know, in my first book, Chaos, Newton's name appears quite a bit, and I used him as a sort of shorthand for a deterministic science that the chaos theorists were overthrowing, or at least rebelling against. But while that was true as far as it went, it wasn't fair to Newton the man, who wasn't that orderly in his personal life.
Well, even his system, as you write, was not entirely orderly. It left a great deal of room for the unknowable, the mysterious, the divine, perhaps. You say at one point that he was a mechanist and a mathematician to his core, but he could not believe in a nature without spirit. I find that kind of reassuring. He was not a total scientific reductionist.
No, and he never thought that his system was a thing that was complete. He never thought he had been on a quest and fulfilled it. He thought he was leaving for posterity, if anything, a lot of unanswered questions. Which, of course, he was. He was laying the foundations for a lot of work that then began to be performed over centuries to come. What we need to understand about Newton, I think, to do him justice, and also for the sheer pleasure of seeing him as he was, is that he lived in a world of strange, mysterious forces. And even his great achievement, gravity, was a strange and mysterious thing.
Yes, indeed.
It wasn't a mechanical thing. I mean, this was a time when the scientific revolution was about mechanism and machines and one object pressing against another object, and Newton worked out all the math for that. But when it came to gravity, he had to resort to something that his contemporaries, who were scientists, hated and mistrusted.
Right.
Because it's a mysterious, invisible force acting at a distance.
Yeah.
There is no mechanical explanation for it. In Newton's scope, all he can say is That has to be there because the math works out. There's no other way to explain all the phenomena of the universe.
Right, and others did say, you know, it's just spookery. It's the X factor. It's just nonsense.
Right. They thought he was taking a step backward and resorting to ghosts again.
Yeah. Let me ask you two questions about Newton. What would Newton make of the people who created in his name a kind of entirely rational world? What would he make at the kind of embarrassment in the social and, shall we say, emotional sciences of people to find ultimate laws of human nature and human behavior?
I think that he would respect the search for scientific principles, even in these difficult areas of the softer sciences. And it's easy for us to laugh sometimes. I mean, if you like hard science and then you look at people in economics or even a little bit softer psychology or even softer than that, sociology or anthropology, people in these fields that don't automatically lend themselves to explication according to scientific laws. If you see these people attempting to use scientific laws in the Newtonian fashion with his kind of language, you have a choice. You can say, well, that's comical, that's not going to work, and of course a lot of the time it doesn't work. But Newton did that himself. He was trying to understand a lot of complex phenomena in the world that were out of his reach. That's what his work in alchemy was about. He was trying to do what we can do now in a more scientific realm of chemistry. He was trying to look at materials, some of which were dead, some of which were alive, all of which were too difficult for him to make headway on because the world just hadn't progressed far enough. It had just gotten to the point where there was enough data about astronomical objects that he could do the calculations and discover the underlying laws. In chemistry, it wasn't near that point. Centuries of work remained to be done, and we're still doing it. We're still teasing out the strange forces that operate at the level of subatomic particles and trying to understand the laws in the Newtonian fashion. So while it's dangerous to say what this guy who lived 300 years ago would think about anything in the modern world, I think he would respect the search for principles, even if he himself never fooled himself into thinking that he had achieved or could achieve any kind of final answer.
Your book reminded me of a wonderful man at MIT who died a couple of years ago, much too young. Michael Dutouzos was his name. He ran the computer lab at MIT from a very early time in the history of computers. Toward the end of his life, Michael Dutouzos wrote that the great bug in our mental systems now was not the Y2K problem. He said it's the enlightenment bug, by which he meant the separation of zones of thinking, feeling, the segregation of thinking about science, about the humanities, and about religion. He said we've divided the world into techies, humies for humanists, and believers. Michael Dutouzos himself was a scientist, he was a humanist, and he was an Orthodox Greek Christian. And he said the trick is to reunite these areas of thinking in which, for most of human history, have coexisted. I wonder how you suppose Newton would address this.
I'm really troubled by this for all kinds of personal reasons. It's a really important question. Newton lived in a time, maybe it's the time that Michael Dutouzos wishes we could go back to, when there was no divorce between the secular and the spiritual. Newton himself was a profoundly religious man. He would have been horrified at the idea, which became popular centuries later, that he had made the world safer for atheism. He was no atheist. On the other hand, when I look at our world, I'm not sure it's the separation between science and religion that bothers me. Or maybe it is. You know, there, on the day you and I are speaking, Chris, we have this craziness going on in Alabama where religious fundamentalists are demonstrating because the secular law requires the removal from public institutions of religious iconography, namely a little monument that a judge down there has put up for the Ten Commandments.
Mm.
And this judge, this conservative Christian, believes that we Americans need to understand that all morality flows from religion, and specifically from the Christian religion. Well, I don't really like that, personally.
No, and I don't think Newton would either.
I wish I could know where Newton would stand. He lived in a time of great intellectual ferment when the very possibility of his doing what we now see as science depended on a kind of birth of intellectual freedom in England on a scale that didn't quite exist yet on the rest of the continent. You know, Galileo was famous for his run-in with the Inquisition. Newton didn't encounter any of that kind of difficulty. There was nothing anti-religious about his scientific work.
Well, yes or no, Jim. I mean, you write that he got himself an exemption from the standard Cambridge rule that he would have to be an ordained minister because he didn't want to vent his disbelief in the Trinity.
Yes. Newton had a secret and, I would say, technical disagreement with established Protestantism in England at his time, which was that he didn't believe in the Trinity. And there he was teaching at Trinity College, Cambridge.
Hmm.
But it was a technical point, and he had to keep this point secret, or he would have lost his job. He could even have lost his freedom. It didn't mean that he was any less of a devout Christian. He believed in God. He just didn't believe that the Son and the Father and the Holy Ghost were three co-equal parts of the Godhead. He didn't believe that Christ was fully divine, as Trinitarians do. So, to that extent, he was a heretic, and he had to keep his beliefs secret. But I don't think there was any necessary connection between that particular heresy and his ability to do physics. His physics was very much connected to his belief in God. He believed that God was everywhere in the universe. He didn't believe that God had set things going like a clockwork machine and abandoned the field, for example, as we commonly think he did. So how would he feel about a secular state or a science that is completely divorced from God? I'm not sure. And yet, we Newtonians, I believe, do trust scientists. Or if we don't, we should. We trust our scientists, as I have said, when they calculate the paths of planets and spaceships. We trust them because we've seen the results. We know that their mathematics works, and we get into elevators and automobiles and jet planes with a mystical faith that these things are more often than not going to avoid falling from the sky. And yet, some of us are anti-scientific and don't trust our scientists when they tell us how evolution works. Or, for political reasons, some of us don't want to trust our scientists when they tell us why the world's climate is changing in such a dramatic fashion.
Mm.
And so what I see around us is a lot of anti-science and irrationality, sometimes with religious motivation and sometimes with just a political motivation. And it distresses me, and I would like to think that Newton would object to it because it's so based on irrationality.
Well, you make an interesting point, but it also seems to me that Newton is still an example of a deeply, obsessively, persistently rational inquirer who also leaves room for mystery, even mystery words like gravity, and leaves room for awe at all the things he did not understand. Aren't those still kind of exemplary?
I think this is the essential paradox of Newton, that he created modern rationality. Rationality was the bedrock of his thinking, and yet he was not a wholly rational man, nor did he intend to be. He wasn't just irrational because that was a defect in his personality. He was open to mystical things. He saw all kinds of phenomena in nature that he couldn't explain in terms of pure reason. And yet he created a form of argumentation, a form of proof, a form of persuasion that depended on reason and experiment and logical argument. That works. That's the basis of science, and it works so well that, as you said at the beginning of our discussion, the computers sitting on our desks flow directly from it. And yet, it wasn't the be-all and end-all for Newton himself.
What in the world would Isaac Newton say, or say that he anticipated about this whole world of electronics, including consumer electronics and computer electronics, and the blogosphere that we all live in now?
No. He would not have anticipated any part of that. And in fact, it's hard for us to imagine how unimaginable this world of blogosphere and the internet and instantaneous global communication and universal understanding and access to knowledge would have been to Newton. He not only didn't anticipate it, but he lived in a world that for us seems like the antithesis of that. And so for me to understand Newton involved a kind of subtraction of everything we know about the flow of information. Information traveled very slowly. And the consequences of that are almost unimaginable to us. We're talking about the birth of science here and the birth of scientific institutions and habits and traditions. And to understand them, we have to realize how perishable information was.
How about electronics itself?
As a technology?
Yeah.
Too far away. What Newton could see was that if you rubbed a piece of paper against a piece of glass, funny things happened. In the dark, he could see sparks. He could see a kind of attraction that he sensed, but he couldn't know for sure was different from gravitational attraction or from magnetic attraction. We can see, in retrospect, that he was on the brink of talking about electricity, but the word barely existed, and he did what he could, and now we're talking about the end of his career when he was the president of the Royal Society and an old man. He did what he could to lay the foundations for the work on electricity that followed in the next century, but it was so far from modern electronics that it's difficult to overstate the vast gulf that remained between Newton's time and ours.
We owe it all to him, but he couldn't have imagined it. Jim, you've written an absolutely wonderful book about a stupendous mind, and I really just wanted to thank you for it and share it with as many people as we can.
Well, thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed this conversation.
So have I. Jim Glick, thank you.